inhaled particles and mortality.
When you stop cigarette smoking, when does your risk of heart disease decline?
Screening for BRCA1 and 2 mutations.
And is there an association between oral antibiotic use and GI cancer?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on August 23rd, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, let's turn first to the New England Journal of Medicine. We have talked so many times in the last 15 years, crazy as that sounds, about these inhaled particles and their impact on health. And there have been a lot of studies relative to that. In this particular study, they took a look at ambient particulate air pollution and daily mortality in 652 cities across the globe. Wow, there's a lot of data for you. And I'd actually like to say to folks, hey, go there and take a look at some of these maps because they're extremely revelatory with regard to where is this particulate matter the highest and its relationship to mortality. So they take a look at two different particle sizes, 10 micrometers or less, and 2.5 micrometers or less with daily all-cause cardiovascular and respiratory or respiratory mortality across all kinds of countries and regions. They took a couple measurements of this, and they used an assessment of two-day moving average of particulate matter, the average over the previous day and the current day. They also took a look at annual mean temperatures, and they finally also factored out things that are other types of pollution, nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and ozone and carbon monoxide, so that they could see, okay, what is it that's independently associated with these particles? Basically, what they show is that short-term exposure is associated with daily all-cause cardiovascular and respiratory mortality. And there are independent associations of both of these size of particles after adjusting for these gases that I already mentioned. Interestingly, they found that these associations were still detectable at concentrations that are below the current air quality guidelines and regulatory limits.
One of the strengths of this study is 652 cities in 24 different countries. The smaller the particle was and the higher the annual temperature was, the more likely there was an increase in all-cause mortality, respiratory mortality, and cardiovascular mortality. Very good evidence that the particulate pollution increased overall mortality and the individual ones from about 0.4% to about 0.7% daily.
One of my concerns is that, again, we always are talking about the impact of global warming and the keeping all these particles in the air so that they're inhaled more readily.
Yep. We really can't change the temperature acutely, but we can reduce pollutants that we put in the air. And that's going to be important if we're going to reduce mortality across the globe.
Okay. Which of yours would you like to turn to?
Let's talk to this association of cigarette smoking cessation and the risk of cardiovascular disease. Once you stop cigarette smoking, how long does it take for your cardiovascular risk to normalize, for example, to somebody that never smoked? The investigators looked at over 8,700 individuals that have been followed for a total of about 26 years. This was all part of the Framingham trial. Remember, that started back in the 1940s, so we have the original cohort going back to the 1950s, and then their offspring more recently. Here's what they determined. When people stop cigarette smoking, the risk of cardiovascular disease declined quickly over the next 5 years. It decreased by about 39%. However, it didn't really normalize for another 10 to 15 years.
This, of course, in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Is there anything that anybody can do to accelerate this process? For example, does taking on a serious aerobic exercise program help?
This particular study really doesn't address that. They did note, by the way, that in the original Framingham population, the risk declined over 10 or 15 years. In their offspring, it took as much as 26 years for it to decline. And the reason for that is really inexplicable right now. The only other thing I'd mention is that some of the risk formulas that we use for calculating someone's risk of cardiovascular disease, they assume that the risk normalizes 5 years after cigarette smoking has stopped. And now we know that's probably not true. So some of those risk formulas may actually underestimate the risk of cardiovascular disease in people that have stopped cigarette smoking recently.
I think we just outlaw the things and be done with it. What do you think?
I think that would be a wonderful thing. Not to even talk about the issues regarding vaping.
Okay. Since we're in JAMA, let's stay there. Let's take a look at the USPSTF's new set of recommendations regarding testing women for BRCA1 and 2 mutations. We're well aware, of course, that those mutations increase the risk for breast cancer. Breast cancer is second most common cancer after non-melanoma, skin cancers, and second leading cause of cancer death. They took a look at this last in 2013. They, of course, reviewed all the evidence, as they always do, and they've expanded the guidelines this time. This time, they're saying that primary care physicians should be assessing women with a personal or a family history. Previously, they excluded the personal history of breast, ovarian, tubal, or peritoneal cancers, or who have an ancestry that's associated with the BRCA1 and 2 gene mutations. They should use a brief familial risk assessment tool and then send them on for appropriate testing and genetic counseling if it's indicated. And they give that a B recommendation. With regard to routine risk assessment, genetic counseling, or genetic testing for women who don't have any of those things, they say, no, don't do it. One of the editorialists, this inclusion of women with prior breast and ovarian cancer is an important step forward. They also illustrate that there are plenty of women who are at risk but who don't get tested. They also admit that implementation of this testing is challenging because there's a lot of complexity that gets added to it. And I would second that. When I look at the algorithm for breast cancer, both assessment and treatment, I'm just like, I need some help to navigate that whole thing. Now they have multi-gene panel testing. It's largely replaced this BRCA1 and 2. And they can also choose genetic testing panels with as many as 80 genes. And then adding to that is the fact that now we have direct-to-consumer testing, and it's unclear exactly what the role is for that.
Previous recommendations were to evaluate women that had a family history of breast or ovarian cancer. The general BRCA mutations occur in about 1 to 300 to 1 to 400 individuals just across the population. But in Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, it occurs in 1 in 40 individuals. So that's another group that's recommended, even in the absence of known family history or personal history, they be tested as well. Now, all this has to be combined with genetic counseling, by the way. Three things that are addressed in this particular article. One is if you know that someone has a BRCA mutation, you may be doing more intensive screening for cancer. Number two is there are some medications that are known to decrease the risk of cancer, aromatase inhibitors, for example. And the last is some women that have BRCA mutations, especially with the family history, may decide to have prophylactic bilateral mastectomies or actually have their tubes and ovaries taken out. And we know that those maneuvers are effective in reducing the risk of cancer in those organs, obviously, by as much as 80 to 100%.
Let's turn to the last one then. That's in the journal Gut. And that's taking a look at, well, if you've taken oral antibiotics, have you increased your risk for colon cancer?
So first of all, you got to love a journal named Gut because you know exactly what it's about. There's no question. There were a couple of things I found interesting. One, Elizabeth, if you go back in 2010, the latest data we have, the estimated global consumption of antibiotics was 70 billion, that's with a B, individual doses. Now, there were some epidemiologic studies that suggested that there was an association between antibiotic use and gastrointestinal cancer. You say, well, why would that be? Well, it's not the medicine causing cancer, but the medicine changed the gut microbiome. And the gut microbiome is thought to be protective. And obviously, if you give antibiotics, there's a possibility of now having a more pathogenic gut microbiome. So to address this issue of whether oral antibiotic use did actually increase the risk of colorectal cancer, the authors turned to what is the one of the world's largest electronic medical record databases of anonymized clinical records. From the United Kingdom, it's called the CPRD, Clinical Practice Research Data Link. And they looked at almost 30,000 colorectal cancer cases and had about four times as many controls and compared the two. And what they discovered was that, in fact, oral antibiotic use was associated with colorectal cancer, but it differed somewhat by the anatomy. So, for example, there was a clear dose-dependent relationship between antibiotic use and the risk of colon cancer in the proximal, that is the initial part of the colon. Especially, by the way, if individuals took penicillin-like drugs that kill some of the anaerobes. It increased the risk of that cancer by about 10%. However, the rectal cancer, that is the more distal cancer, was actually decreased by the use of antibiotics, especially tetracycline antibiotics. And by the way, it took about 10 years between the antibiotic use and the increased risk of colorectal cancer. And by the way, that's what you would presume if it changed the gut microbiome, and the gut microbiome increases the risk of inflammation and increases the risk of polyps, which subsequently increase the risk of cancer. Now we need to go back to the drawing board and figure, what is it about the antibiotic use that perhaps changes the microbiome, and in what way that increases the risk of cancer, and how can we avoid that? Obviously, one of the major things, we've always talked about this, is antibiotic steward. That is, only use antibiotics when they're indicated and for the shortest amount of time as possible.
One of the things that I think is interesting about this study is this whole idea of how can we explain this increase in colorectal cancer among people who are younger? And maybe this is one of the factors.
Anything that causes increased inflammation of the gut, or now recent data suggests that there are, in fact, microbiomes that are associated with an increased risk of cancer. And the question was, is there an association? Does someone have a genetic predisposition to both the microbiome and to the cancer that are independent? Or, in fact, is it the change in microbiome that actually causes cancer? And we know that it's been associated with other things like obesity, some inflammatory diseases, and now suggesting that the microbiome, in fact, may increase the risk of colorectal cancer. And by modifying it with antibiotics, we increase that risk.
A lot more work to be done on this one. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.